For the record, I'm done trying to make y'all comfortable. That's right. For the record, you ain't trying to grow, then it's done for you. That's right. For the record, lab on me going all the way. All the way. For the record, ain't trying to link, no time to waste. Stop calling. For the record, 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 for the record. For the record, I'm done trying to make y'all comfortable. That's right.
Welcome to this special Best of the Clink, Series 1 and Series 2. Simo will be back with Season 3 of the Clink mid-January, but in the meantime, we thought we'd take you back to some of our favourite episodes. You can go back and listen to the full chats in your podcast app. In the meantime, let's head back to Season 1, Episode 1, the bloke who kicked it all off and told us the time he escaped from Silverwater Jail in a stolen helicopter. This is John Killick.
Yeah, I was gone. And
so you pinched, you're locked up. They've got you.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's for sure.
Oh, she's
they
freezing.
They didn't want to leave me there because I had a history of escape and that. They just wanted me away. So they put me. I was lucky. I thought I'd finished up that rotten bloody place down at Surrey Hills. But I was lucky. They sent me straight to Silverwater. So we get to Silverwater. Lucy come out and she cut her hair. She had really long hair and... she cut it. I said, what did you do that for? She said, it's the Russian thing. She said, when you're out again, I'll grow it again. So I said to her, we're going to have to call it off. But she wouldn't hear that. And I said, well, look, we sat down. And I said, well, all right, look, I'll try and find a way out. But it looks pretty hard to me. You know, maximum modern security. It just looked almost impossible.
Well, Silverwater too, John. I was there. I know exactly.
Yeah,
the place,
yeah.
And you don't get out of there.
It is
built to hold you in there because of people like yourself that have proven that jails can be escaped from. So,
well, this is true, I guess, but there's always a way, and I just thought there's got to be a way if you can find it, and I saw all the choppers coming at it. Went out in the oval, and I just seen them. They were coming over and like 20 a day.
And this was during the Olympics, wasn't it?
They were building the Olympic Stadium, and the Olympics was only about a year away. And and people were coming all the time doing the sightseeing over there. And I knew that any jail, other jail, like Goulburn, Bombani, chopper coming over there, they'd be on it straight away.
Yeah, but exactly.
But I watched them, and they dropped their guard. They just weren't worried about the choppers because there were 20 a day. And I thought, shit. This is, if ever a guy can pull a chopper escape off, it's here. But I don't know anything about how we're going to do it. So I said to her, look, this is what we've got to do. Well, and then I had a stroke of luck that the guy comes, they extradite him from South Africa and then from Scotland. He went from South Africa to Scotland over to here. He's New Zealand, the con man. He's a helicopter pilot.
Right.
And they put him, there's 20 pods and they put him in my pod.
Yep.
So then I arranged for him to get into my cell, get up the man, and he's trying to con me and that he can get me out, et cetera. He knew who I was for a certain amount of money, and I told him I had the money from the bank. It hadn't been recovered. So it was sort of a little chess game, and he's pumping me and I'm pumping him. She's putting money in his property and doing things for him, and I'm finding out everything there is to know about helicopters, and I learn about transponder, which is a silent alarm through the authorities. If I hadn't known about that, they would have got us. So it was just a stroke of luck that I got him in there. I knew that we could pull it off. She went for a trial run, and she was excited about it. She said, we can do it. And I said, did you see where the transponder was? And she knew where it was. And I said, well, he'll probably go for it. You got to make sure he doesn't get that transponder on. So it was set for the day, certain day. You only get out twice a week on the oval.
That's right, yep.
And yeah, and you're only there for an hour. We knew it had to be, she had to know I was there because the week before we were going to do it and didn't do it. And a Muslim guy hanged himself, poor guy, and they just shut the whole jail there.
Well, the thing is, too, if they don't have the staff there, they don't send you out. It's as simple as that.
That's exactly right.
You just never know when you're going to get out to get exercise or, you know, out of your slot. And it's just fucked.
That was the difficulty of it. And, you know, you can imagine that. You know, if she did it and I'm not there, you know, arranged to ring her and on her mobile, and she was near the airport when I rang her. And I said, I went to the guy, and I managed to get the phones with the guy. I said, you guys, I've got to ring a lawyer. I only be 30 seconds. They let me push in because I had to. And so I've just rang her and said, I said to the screw, we're going out to the Oval. He said, yeah, another 10 minutes. So I said, look, I'm going out for a run. I'll call you when I get back. Well, that was the signal. And when I got out there, it was late because they didn't, something had happened to the chopper that he had, and he had to get a smaller one. And they were running late. I saw about 15 choppers come over. And
how was your anxiety, mate? Like sitting there knowing that your chopper's coming to get you, muster's almost coming up, you're going to get put back in the slot. Everything was revolving around luck, wasn't it?
And it would be. He was walking out. That's another thing they got dirty about, because there was always a chance the pilot would land and jump out and run across the Oval. So I had a backup pilot. 10 minutes to go, I thought, geez, it's just not going to happen. Well, I knew she'd do it, but I thought, she's going to be late. Man, she gets here, there's a different group of guys there. She'll land the chopper. It would be the worst stand-up day in history, you can imagine. You know, I mean, you get there and finish up getting a different guy on board. Because a lot of guys said they would have jumped on. So there's always that one guy who might have done it. But so finally it comes about 7 minutes to go, because I'd already worked out I was going to collapse on the ground. There'd be a few stragglers, and so I'm having a heart attack.
Well, yep.
They don't pick you up. They get the nurse. They don't pick you up. And it might have given us another 10 minutes. I could have jumped up and ran to the chopper if it came. And, but she came, and so I started to run across. Jeff sang out, good luck, you shifty bastard. I remember him singing out that. All the screws, they're all bunched together. They're looking at it, and he deliberately trying to attract attention to himself to the pile. He shouldn't have done it. He did circle, coming around in slow circle, instead of just sweeping straight in and out. And that gave him time to set up. And but luckily, I was just standing there instead of spreading out. And when it landed, it didn't land, it hovered about a metre and a bit off the ground.
So you actually had to jump up onto the chopper. Fuck.
I had to jump on it. And I ran and jumped onto it. And you got to remember, I'm 57 at the stage.
That's what I mean. Like, that's pretty fucking good.
Hey? I reckon a 90-year-old could have done it with the heart pumping, the adrenaline would have been going on.
Yeah, the adrenaline would have been fucking pumping hard.
I had the screw from the weights room running across, and he was coming pretty fast. And then the other screw was starting, and I jumped in and onto the side. I got on the side, and she handed me we had a sawn-off machine gun.
Yep.
And I sat on the thing, and I just spun around, aiming it at the guys, and they threw themselves in the ground. And I was very lucky because two guys, the dog squad, had arrived, and they arrived just over to the right where they've got this little road that goes right around the jail, and they jumped out with pistols. But at the same time, the guy from the tower fired off three shots. Now, he shouldn't have. He's not allowed. Under the Geneva Convention, not allowed, and I knew that. I wouldn't have done it if I knew he was going to fire shots. He's fired three shots, and I was in the chopper by that stage, and I heard it go, poof. So I knew we'd been hit, but it just missed this coaxial cable goes through. If it had hit, that would come down. The two screws, the dog squad, when they heard the shots, they thought I was firing at them, and they dived onto the ground, which really saved us. And so we flew out and got away. First thing she said to me, look, I've forgotten the keys to the car. And I thought, well, she's done everything, got anything else, so, you know, it's understandable. So when we got out, we had to tie him up. And Lucy wanted to take him as a hostage. I said, no, look, it's only more trouble. Better off leaving him there. And I commandeered a car, called the car over, and said, look, I need you to drive us somewhere in the city. I was giving him instruction and watching. There was a car flying. I said, that car there behind us, a Telstra car, is that a friend of yours? He said, no, I know nothing about it. So we'll go to the third one. We weren't being followed, so we got down, and I deliberately got to drive home where I live because I wanted to throw them off the track, and I wanted them to think I'd come home, so they'd give us time to get out, because that's what happened. They thought I'd come home here. They threw a net around the suburb, and they'd give us time. We had to get out before that net closed out. And so I got him to stop the car down the park down here, told him to get out. I said, I'll leave the car not far away. And then I drove off. And as I did, just as I drove around the corner, a police car came. And he hollered down, telling what happened. But he was so upset that they were cancelling it. If they'd have gone straight after us, they probably would have got us. So we had a lot of luck, and I drove it up to North Sydney. I don't live very far away from here, and we got out and caught a train.
Another old-timer was Bernie Matthews from Season 1, Episode 3. Bernie is a convicted bank robber, prison escapee, and is now an award-winning journalist. Bernie told us a few yarns of his time in some of Australia's toughest prisons.
That was the story. I got recaptured and, I was taken back to Parramatta. And that's when my dramas really began.
Righto, much time.
What I did is I'd committed the cardinal sin. I'd escaped from the Central Industrial Prison. They didn't know how I got out, and I wouldn't tell them how I got out. So as far as they were concerned, I was just a security risk and to be kept under extreme conditions of security. Now, back in those days, the maximum security was a circle at Parramatta. Yeah, the circle was it's exactly what it says. It was a circle segmented into yards, like an orange cut into wedges.
Okay.
And they had a guard tower on the top of the circle, and the screw stayed in the guard tower, and he could look into the yards to make sure everyone was there, etc. And you were taken from your cell about 8 o'clock, and then you were put in the yard until about, say, 11 o'clock. Then you were put back in the cell over lunch, and you were taken out in the afternoon. That was the routine. As I said, I was contained in those conditions for some time.
It's called the Circle, and it's a jail within a jail. You're sent here for two reasons, for breaking prison rules or for your own protection. At worst, a prisoner can spend 28 days straight in here. It's primitive, old-fashioned. Prisoners say they feel like caged animals.
What a boil, isn't it?
The next escape attempt was the prison van. They used to take you to Fairfield Police Station. I had the front court at Fairfield because I was recaptured out that way. And in those days, they had the old paddy wagons, which were like a wire cage with a bit of canvas over the top of it.
Yes.
I worked out a way that if you got a biro and you cut a slot in the biro and you had a small piece of hacksaw blade, because you couldn't carry an entire hacksaw blade out of the jail and get through the search. But a small one, yeah, you could
snooker it.
Yeah. Paper between your shoulder blades, you could hide it, without any major problem. The problem with a smaller hacksaw blade was you couldn't hold it to cut. You needed a handle. Going to court, I needed to have biros for my court notes because I was defending myself.
Right.
So I cut a slot in the biro, fitted the hacksaw blade into that, and that made a portable hacksaw. It took about 6 or 7 trips in the same van to get through the roof of the van. Anyway, I thought, I'm on my way here. Each trip to Fairfield to go to court, I cut 1.5 or 2 bars, and then eventually I was ready to roll. The morning I'm ready to go, I go over to the depth office with my court papers and all the rest of it, and I get strip searched. It was one of the heaviest searches I ever got. And I thought to myself, oh, something's wrong here. They're all the coppers are smiling. Anyway, something's wrong. I go out, and it's a different van.
Oh,
so I
fuck.
Know something. I know something's wrong.
Wow.
Well, nobody says anything, but you just get the feeling, the heavy search, van. Yeah, something's wrong. So we get to Fairfield. Well, of course, the local jacks, the local detectives, they couldn't keep their mouths shut. They were all laughing and giggling. They thought, you thought you were going home today, didn't you, Matthews? Anyway, I never said nothing. They just copped it on the chin, and one of them let the cat out of the bag. What had happened is back in those days, there was a thing called the apartheid in South Africa. And there was a big thing about apartheid and about the Springboks playing rugby over in Australia. Well, they had demonstrations at one of the big parks down there. They were going to have the football match. Well, all these demonstrators had decided they're going to demonstrate against the Springboks playing Australia in the rugby.
Yes.
Anyway, they called in all the police vans from all over Sydney and Western Sydney. Well, of course, they've got all these police vans lined up for all the demonstrators. Well, One demonstrator got this bloke, and he's escaped, and he's jumped up on the top of the vans. He's running along the top of 20 police vans. Then all of a sudden, he gets to about 18
straight through it,
and he falls through the roof. Well, of course, the coppers have said, "Where's that van from?"
Fucking bear trap.
Said, "It's from Fairfield." who's the runner that's fronting Fairfield Court? Matthews. It's got to be Matthews.
Oh, no.
That brought that one undone. It was just, you know, it was just one of those things, you just couldn't take into account.
How would they transport you around, Bernie? Like, that obviously should have told them, mate, you need to be in a steel fucking, like, solidified machine car.
Yeah, that's what they got now. That other carload of Jack's behind, following the van, and carload in front from there on in. So, you know, they didn't take any precautions after that.
Russell Manser is a convicted bank robber and a heroin addict, and he turned his life around and started a company called Voice of a Survivor, who have been massive supporters of the podcast since it started. In Season 1, Episode 5, Russell told Simo of some tough times, but some of the times he told us about actually made us laugh.
So the morning of the escape, there was about five of us going on, and I jumped on the truck and said, everyone ready to go, and we had these bags of salt up near our gooch. Tucked away. We'd practiced it a couple of times on the blokes in the yard. So you just walk up to them and throw a handful of salt in their eyes and see what they do. The first thing they do is that feel burns and they cover up.
That's right. And then you're watering your eyes, you're rubbing it, it's getting worse.
And you get a punch on the chin to go with it.
Good night, Irene.
Yeah. We'd done a bit of a practice run on that and it worked. And so when we jumped off the van, I come off first and I threw the salt in the copper's eyes and put one on him. And he was falling down as I was running over his chest. And went back and robbed one of the banks that I was already on remand for. Yes. Vietnamese security guard was very kind. He handed his gun.
Wow.
He's 32 Browning, the old...
So they must have really given you what you wanted the first time to go back in there.
I wasn't impressed. No, I was actually... They were very kind. They were very kind. I can joke about that sort of stuff now because my life's a lot different. But
sure.
What happened was I flew over to Perth, and then I went up to Broome, and then I flew over to Darwin. And then the first night in Darwin, my co-accused met a girl who was a bank manager and who became friends, and we were staying at her house anyway. We just showed us the sights of Darwin and we sort of getting a bit short on cash, so we robbed the ANZ Bank at Perap in Darwin. And that was the first at a time. It was the first time that Nike could bring their logo out, Just Do It.
Just Do It. Were you wearing a pair of 180s or something back then?
Yeah, I had the bright... fluorescent green,
with
Just
big
Do It.
Tick.
Yeah, just Do It. And the hood had South Sydney socks pulled right up to my knees, and we just did it. And,
what a fucking motto.
Yeah.
And what do you do? I just do it. Do what, Rob Banks?
Yeah, and we unfortunately, Darwin was a lot smaller than we thought, you know, being from a big city like Sydney.
Yeah, Darwin is a bit of a culture shock when you go into it. There's not much there at all. I think it's two or three streets.
I was thinking when we robbed the bank, we'll disappear into the suburbs. And they said, there's only one suburb, Palmerston or something like that. And anything, not a suburb after that. My co-accused had tattoos of asterisks on his knuckles. And we went to the airport about 3 days later, and he tried to jump on a plane to Sydney, and he got dragged off. So I followed him to the police station in this girl's car. He didn't jump out, so I drove off. I jumped onto a bus. I drove down to a bus stop at a place called Mataranka.
Mataranka, just out of Catherine.
Yeah, I jumped on a bus there, and then along the way, I thought, you know, I better change my identity a bit. So I bought this. A Kubra hat with the corks hanging off it. And I love the Australia T-shirt.
Was this near the caravan park in Mataranka in the main
street? But we're just stopping. So at when I got to Pine Creek, I bought these secondhand hiker's boots with the socks pulled up to the knees. And I was doing my best to look like a German backpacker, you know. And I was doing my best to look like a German backpacker. But you know, I pulled some girl on the bus, and I said, "Oh, when we get to Alice Springs, I said I'll take you to a 5-star hotel," and you know, and she was stoked about that.
So you were sweet. You were cashed.
Yeah, I was cashed. So about 10,000-15,000 in my man bag thing back in the day.
Yes.
And so anyway, I got to Alice Springs, and I was just about to jump. I jumped off the bus, all these blokes jumped me, and they were coppers and that. And so I put on my best Swedish backpacker voice. I said, "What are you doing, you bully?" And I'm looking at this girl, I'm saying, Helga, Helga, call the embassy, call the embassy. And
wow.
And they looked shocked. I seen these cops looking. I said, leave me alone, you bully. Leave me alone. What so are you doing?
You bunged it right on.
Oh, I bunged it right on. And I had a tattoo of a bluebird on my shoulder at the time. I've since got it covered up. And this old copper come over and he had a roll in his mouth. His name was Les Smith. And you know, as far as coppers go, we want a bad bloke. He goes, okay, Hans from Sweden. You haven't got a tattoo on your shoulder? He said, you're free to go. And he lifted up my shirt with a ruler. He said, you're pinched, mate.
Really?
Yeah. He wasn't a bad old copper, that. You know, I'm used to them coppers punching your face in.
That's right.
Trying to load you up, trying to get you to, you know, trying to verbal you and everything like that. And he was nothing like that. And he said, you know, he goes, mate, he was doing impersonations all, I'm Hans from Sweden, and fucking, give us another one of them, mate. He was really, he'd never met anything like it. And he said, no. So, and then they flew me back to Darwin, put me in a police lineup, and I had these blokes saying, mate, did you do it? Did you do it? And I'm saying, mate, what? You just admitted you robbed the bank. And I was telling, and it was the first time I ever tried being a lawyer myself. You know, I ran our own committal for me and my coey, and we're doing pretty good at that.
So, can I just ask you too? So, just, this is a man still with a heroin addiction.
Yeah.
How are you going?
I was just waiting for the opportunity to get on it again, and it wasn't presenting itself out there. So
were you getting sick?
Oh no, I wasn't. I didn't have a habit at that stage because I just got out of jail. But when I did escape, it was the first thing I went and done was went and got on, and the dealer was very happy to see me again because he knew I was a good customer, was paid in cash,
yep,
and didn't have to worry about credit and that for me. But when, you know, by the time I got to Western Australia, and it wasn't just really accessible to us. And you know, a heroin addict can find it anywhere.
And then there was Mahmoud Fazel from Series 2, Episode 2, who went from motorcycle gang life to award-winning writer for Vice.
Like when I was fucking around at school, I was also making a bit of money in that, you know, like I had older relatives, people in my community that were, you know, giving me money and giving me gear and that to do runs on a push bike.
So you were doing drugs, like selling drugs basically. Is that right?
Yeah, when I was like 14, 15, you know, like very young, like dropping off, you know, dropping off smack and all that, you know.
Yep.
It was very normal in our area. It was just that time, you know what I mean? I went to uni, I did pretty well, but then, you know, what do you do with a fine art degree? Not much, you know what I mean? Like when you're studying art, you know, to try and have a career in art, it's a very difficult thing. So it was like a fine art degree that centered around film, like it was mainly a film course, like so I did that, and I did pretty well, like won a bunch of awards, got out, couldn't get a job anywhere, like applied everywhere for every job under the sun, just couldn't get nothing, you know. A few years passed, went back to the area, started hanging out with the same boys, you know, my family, because all of my friends were either in the city or in the area. And yep. So when I was out of the city back home, I was back in the area with my boys. So I just started waxing with them.
How old?
This is 21.
So life's really just starting to kick off for you. Some big choices obviously have to be made from here on in.
Yeah, so it was like, can't get a job, fucking no one's hiring, waxing back with the boys who never worked anyway, coming out of high school, and they're making money, and then you just start, you know, start doing what you're doing, like start doing what they're doing to make a buck. And then that was a period where, you know, the ice was really kicking off, you know, it seemed in my area, everyone was on it. Yeah. Back then, like we're talking 2010.
Yes.
You know, around that area, 2011, it seemed like everyone was on it. People like lawyers, accountants, just like everyone that you saw the boys selling to, like it was a party drug.
Ice is the perfect destructive drug. It's easy to make, highly addictive, and it's everywhere. Destroying families, causing carnage on our roads, and murder in our homes.
I didn't even know, mate. I don't even think I knew anyone that was on the rack back then.
Mm.
Like, it was all, everyone was on the eye in that.
Wow.
But then, so, got looped into that, started hitting you know, doing what you have to do to pay for that and, and start pushing that and pushing heavy and start making moves.
Were you indulging in that at that time?
Yeah. I was hitting it hard.
Okay, you were. So you ended up having what I guess would be a habit from that, an addiction, would you say?
Yeah, for sure.
So naturally,
you
know, then
it starts on a Friday, then it's Friday, Saturday, then it just keeps growing and getting a hold of you. And so you just – and then we started making a bit of noise in our area. A lot of people kind of respected us in our areas, and we were doing all the wrong things and – impressing the wrong people or the right people in our eyes at that time, you know. We felt like we, for the first time, we were getting respect and belonging and stuff like that, and validation, you know.
People started
to give us validation, and that encouraged us. And so I was introduced in a roundabout way to a club to represent represents the boys on the inside and that, and that's how I got involved in the club life.
With the club scene, and if you're happy, we'll get into a little bit. Like myself, you're a senior member, had been in around the scene for a long time. What was your first impressions? Putting all that effort in at school and stuff, did you feel some sort of sense of rejection after coming out, maybe because of who you were and that time of the way the world is? Did you feel at all that could have been...
You always play mind games with yourself like that. Like you're always trying to blame everyone but yourself. You know what I mean? You want to blame everything. So there were other things I could have done, obviously, you know, to fix my situation. But I chose the easy way out, man.
You went back to what you know best.
You need to push gear. Do you know what I mean? In my area, that's the sad reality of it. Yep. In my area... It's easy to make money that way. Why our areas are trapped in systems like that and cycles like that, I don't know. I don't have those answers. But all I know is when I was growing up in certain areas, a lot of the boys, that's how they were making money.
Isn't it funny? We talk about areas. I'm a product of the Housing Commission area, the low demographic area of Western Sydney originally. And I got to be honest with you, it was... You weren't accepted if you weren't doing something that wasn't normal, abnormal. You know, like if you went, I know I had, you know, there were blokes out there that had older brothers and that, and a couple of those brothers, you know, would be mechanics or whatever, and they were going to work every day. But they'd still come back to the hood, and then all of a sudden they're still, you know, whether they like it or not, they get mixed into it. And whether it's after work or weekends or whatever it is, you're never 100% detached from that environment. And they say that we become products of our own environment.
And you got to remember, at that time, we're talking now 2012, around that, man, the bikies were like the epitome of being, you know, outcasts, outlaws, you know what I mean? Like being the poster boys of whatever it meant to give a big fuck you to society, you know, in many ways.
I think everything changed around that era too, because, you know, as you would know, the golden rule was, you know, we never put ourselves on show publicly unless, you know, it was needed to be done, but everything was generally in-house. I mean...
And I shouldn't have to say this, but before I get into it, like, we need to understand that whatever I say about a club or the club or anyone I was affiliated with, if you know anything about that world, you know that if you're away for 3 months, let alone 4 or 5 years, that's a totally different club. Like, whatever I say is not representative of what any outlaw club's like, not even the one that I was in. No. Like, I don't represent that. It doesn't have it. And what I'm talking about is a club at a specific moment in time for that moment in time. Most of the blokes, I don't even know, you know, if they're still there. So
on the Clink, we've not only talked about convicted criminals, we've spoke with sports stars like big bad bustling Barry Hall.
If you fuck someone over, everyone's going to know about it, and you're almost branded.
That's
whether
correct.
It's right or wrong, and it just makes people honest. It gives people, you have to be accountable. So I love going back there, because yes, it takes you back in time, but you know, it's really confirms me that this is how people should be. Whether you're in the city, hustle and bustle, you don't need to deceive and lie to people just to get yourself ahead. And that's not me, and I'm glad I've come from a small country town because I've certainly carried those ethics,
values,
through my footy career and onto fatherhood now. So,
right.
That's sort of where I began. My dad was a boxer. You know, he used to train all the local footy club players in pre-season, and we had a gym in the backyard. It was a bag and a speed ball. Probably not much bigger than this. There was no ring set up. And, you know, as a kid, all I wanted to do was impress Dad, make Dad happy.
Were you always quite tall?
No.
So you weren't a tall fella back then. I mean, I'm 6 foot and you tower me.
Yeah.
You're a big man.
I just shot up the age of, 16? I almost grew a foot in a year.
Wow.
Which is crazy. I was always, for the people who know about AFL, I was always an on-baller. So one of those little blokes who run around and, you know, do a lot of Ks, and I was quite a good runner. But once I grew that foot, I had to learn how to play other positions because, you know, you can't be that big.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Playing those positions. So things happened quickly and, you know, I got a deep voice, my balls dropped and got some hair around the balls and things developed pretty quickly. But, I was always interested in boxing and fighting and it was probably one of the tougher things I've ever had to do was tell my dad that I didn't want to fight anymore.
So was your dad an established fighter or was he sort of somebody who was just a great trainer? Did he have any fights himself?
No, so he's just a great trainer. He's a tough old bugger.
Yeah, country
very,
fella.
Very uncompromising. You know, got the hard edge to him. Had a bit of a reputation on the street, which you know, most people think they have. but he did. Yeah, it just sort of stemmed from there. I started doing some training around 10 years of age, just hitting the bags, and then I got to... We're actually into Muay Thai, kickboxing. Yeah,
yep, I
loved
that,
it. Absolutely loved it? Yeah. But unfortunately, couldn't fight full contact. So we said, okay, well, I was 15 years of age, 14, 15. If you want to fight properly... We're going to have to go to boxing. So that's where the decision was. Okay, we'll concentrate on boxing when you turn 18. Then you can go to kickboxing. So that's pretty much what happened.
Let's just move forward a few years. You come into the AFL. I mean, there's a gap, obviously, from 15 to... What were you about, 18, 19, when you kicked off your career with the AFL?
19,
19 at representative level.
Sorry, 18. Sorry.
18. So you've come into the club, into the squads. Did Barry Hall come in with that fire in his belly, as we know you... today, the aggressor, the hard man, the enforcer on the field, the take no fucking prisoners attitude that, mate, without doubt, not pissing in your pocket, mate, you're a man to be fucking, you know, said to be a tough, tough fella.
Hall wanted a free kick, lost his cool, and that is an ugly incident.
I'll tell you what, the look of Brent Staker's eyes
they
after
rolled.
The impact is not going to do Barry Hall a whole lot of good.
Oh, look, I didn't understand it to start with, but since I've done a lot of work on myself and where my mental state was and why I do certain things and why I lose control and...
Brain snaps, I think the media have labelled it. Yeah. The Barry brain snaps.
I had a lot of them. I put a bit of work, invested in myself. Yep. Okay, why am I doing this and I can't do this and I want to be the best dad possible. Sure. So I don't want to be able to teach my kids, okay, this is what I did, this is what I learnt. We can't be doing these sorts of things. So it stemmed from your childhood, obviously.
Absolutely.
From the ages of 0 to 7... It's called your programming.
Yes.
So you're like a computer just downloading information. So a little kid, 1 year of age, trying to learn to eat, looks to mum and dad. How are they eating? And then all of a sudden they pick up a spoon and they start to feed themselves.
Yeah.
I was programmed in a way which was quite violent. Yeah, and it's look, I don't want to get on here and bash anyone, but it's just the truth. I'm naturally not a violent, ruthless, hard person.
Put it down to a little bit more of a product of your environment.
Yes. Absolutely. You're not just born like this. I know there's some cases where genetically people are born with a chemical imbalance in their brain and they're serial killers and all those sorts of things. Most people with my sorts of issues, anger issues, control issues, not letting anyone have anything over you, I'm just not scared of anyone and I'm not trying to be a hero. I'm not.
No.
I don't give a fuck who you are. I'm not going to let you have it over me.
No.
And that's it. That's not naturally me. That's been programmed into me.
Yep.
So, and unfortunately, I know how to handle that now, but it's still in me.
We chatted with the Maloney twins, Australian boxers, who are taking on the world.
No, we are very, very similar people and obviously very, very close. We spend
just about all day, every day with each other and have since we were born. So we're, yeah, extremely close. We push each other pretty hard and we are very competitive. But I think it's been a massive advantage for us, to be honest.
You do?
Yeah, because we've always got each other there to sort of push us on and try and get better. And, you know, if Andrew does something one day and he's getting the better of me, then it sort of pushes me, motivates me and encourages me to get better. And we just keep pushing each other to new heights. So Jason said, like, we were super competitive with each other growing up, and we still are. Like, we'll still push each other every session, and even on the running track, we're trying to outdo each other and beat each other. But back in the day, it was when we'd spar, we'd try and kill each other and try and win the spar.
Absolutely.
And we'd end up rolling around on the floor and trying to take the gloves off. These days, we realise that it's not us that we need to beat. It's the rest of the world. So we try and help each other these days, and Jason will sort of give me advice on what he sees that I could improve on or doing wrong, and I'll do the same for him. And, yeah, as you mentioned, like, we've got the best team in the world, but it is like having another trainer and someone who knows you really well that...
It's you against the world.
Yeah.
That's who you've got to beat.
Mm.
I've never heard an athlete speak like that.
We were probably more the same sort of size back then, I would say, and probably walked around at pretty close to the same weight, but... We both wanted to go to the Commonwealth Games in Delhi 2010, and they changed the weight divisions around in that year, and we both wanted to qualify for the Australian team. So we were both competing. I was at 51 and Jason was at 54, which were probably a good weight class for both of us then.
Realistically, it's just a couple of litres of water.
Yeah. But they changed the weight divisions to 49, 52, 56. Jason decided that he wanted to go at 52, and I probably would have been my comfortable weight as well. But so we could both make the team and represent Australia, I said to Jason, no, you go 52 and I'll get down to 49 kilos. I made the weight. I made 49 kilos, Jason. We both qualified for the Australian team, which was just a massive buzz for us and our family, and everyone was stoked. But obviously you got the tryouts, then you got probably a year or year and a half that I had to hold that weight for until the games came around.
Surely that couldn't have been healthy for you.
I barely ate a thing for that year and a half. And that's why I blame Jason for stunting my growth.
We also went deep, hearing stories of redemption from people that normally just are about having a bit of a laugh. Like the angry dad, Mark Orville, and his battle with mental health.
So you look at life and it's about chapters, right? So your first chapter is growing up. Second chapter was about coming down here to fulfill the dream. The third chapter was dealing with when that dream come to a sudden end. And, you know, how ironic is it that, you know, 20 odd years later, you start to talk about the real third chapter in your life, which was about a really deep and dark place that I was in for nearly 20 years, I reckon. And, you know, the only one that I'd confided in the whole time was just sort of dear old mum and of course Sharon. So, you know, I just couldn't deal with it, Simo. It's as simple as that.
And of course he suffered his injury.
And I tried five different surgeons and it was just beyond repair. Accepting the fact that my dream had been taken away from me without delivering on my own expectations and what I set out to achieve. And it was about then trying to accept it, and I couldn't accept it. For a period of probably 15 years, my life was hell dealing with all that.
Can you take us on that journey of, you know, I think a lot of people listening will never experience what it's like to have something so amazing as such at the top of your game and then to just have it fucking pulled straight from under you. I spoke to Barry Hall on one of my interviews, you know, and we talked about this, about the athlete sort of hitting a peak and the what after.
Well, the comforting thing is you get to see or society gets to see and hear about it more these days, and not just across AFL but across all professional sport, because it's talked about, right? And I think professional sporting outfits are actually now more responsible when it comes to that point in time when that asset is no longer of value to them, that they have an obligation to actually assist them transition into the next chapter of their life. They still are far from perfect with regards to how they do it. but they've come a long way from back in, you know, early 90s when, you know, it hit me head on.
And the thing was too, I mean, we talk about it as men, and let's get a little bit dark on the subject. You know, who were you going to fucking tell you're getting depressed and you're down and you know, you're not happy?
No one.
There's so much in place to just turn to someone and say, mate, I'm fucking not okay. And that person these days would have enough knowledge to just go, mate, do you want to have a chat? You would never tell anyone back then that you were fucking feeling like, because you'd look like a weak piece of shit.
Oh, look, you know, I look back at that whole period and I could sort of, I best summarise it as I pretty much lived two lives for 15, 17 years. And I say that because I had an obligation, I had kids young, right? So an obligation to support the family. And that was about creating a career that could actually, you know, finance that, right? And that was about houses and you want holidays and you want kids to go to schools, this, that, and the other. So I would do that. You'd get up and you put on a brave face and you would actually go and do what you needed to do. And whether that was a junior level sales role or as you transition through to more senior roles, and I was running a manufacturing plant that had a couple hundred people and this, that, and the other. But I'd get home and that work persona, so that sort of professional part of Mark Orville would get parked pretty much immediately. And I was almost a recluse. You know, I'd go into the room, back room, bedroom, whatever, and not want to talk to anyone, do anything.
Yep.
And Sharon ended up doing a lot of things with the kids without me. And I'd be huddled under a blanket down the back room, watching sport and eating shit food as I tried to deal with the demons.
How dark did it get for you, mate?
I think I touched on it in the documentary that on at least two or three occasions, another minute, and I wouldn't be here. And the way, it's really hard. And, in terms of detail, it's not good laying in the car with a hose connected to your exhaust pipe with photos of your family laying on your chest. And
fuck,
I look at that and go, I'm still here. So am I actually strong or am I weak? And I ask myself that question constantly because clearly people that don't get the opportunity to talk about it because they ended up going through with it.
Yep.
They can't ask themselves that question. I can, and I don't know what the answer is. I think it's that I'm strong because at the end of the day, in that last sort of pivotal 20, 30 seconds, the family thing just shone through, and that it was like someone slapped me in the face and said, what the fuck are you doing?
That's really powerful. And I say that from somebody who's a survivor of three major attempts in my life. I get it. I really do. I often ask the question, you know, why am I here? Why am I here right now having this conversation? You know, the father of four beautiful children, you know, the path I've walked when I, you know, my attempts have been extremely serious attempts that didn't fail from my fucking failing. They failed because it either jammed or someone cut me down. Like, without going into specifics and triggering anybody, and please, anybody, if you're feeling anything from this, make sure you reach out. There are people out there that will happily have a chat with you. So, and we'll give some information at the end of this. But, Mark, I get it. I really do, mate. And I think, I don't believe that it's a strength. I don't believe it's a weakness. For me, I look at it as it's a meant to be. I'm meant to fucking be here. You're meant to be here.
Yeah, I got to that point where it was about questioning whether I wanted to be here too. And, you know, again, that's something I've never shared with anyone, but there were some serious moments on at least two or three occasions where one ex probably a minute longer and you wouldn't be doing this interview with me.
Look, it was heartbreaking. You know, I could still cry about it now. Like, and then, sorry. And then I had to watch Dylan go through it as well. So, yeah.
I mean, I had those thoughts that you should never have. Like, I wanted to... Yeah, it's hard to talk about, to be honest.
And then there was Willem Powerfish, who shared his story.
Yeah, like, I think it's great to talk about it, but at the same time, I haven't been honest with, to my followers about actually, I have anxiety and depression, panic, but I don't talk about to the extent. So people may think, oh, okay, so he's got a mental illness, he takes medication. Yeah, I'll take medication, but you know, people don't realise that I'm in fear nearly 24/7, 24 hours a day. Like, going to sleep at night is, and this sounds fucking dumb, but it's scary. And I don't know why, and I don't know why it happens, but, yeah, it's so hard to explain, panic disorder. And when it comes on, you feel like you're going to fucking die and freak out or flip out, and you got crazy things running through your fucking head, and you're thinking, you know, why am I thinking this stuff? Like, you know, and you've got to try and bring yourself back to reality. And, like, you know, all that's happening right now is that you've got a shitload of adrenaline running through your body, and for no reason at all, and you're freaking out, like you're just fucking losing it. And yeah, it's real difficult.
Do you find with your gambling that gave you anxiety, or did it actually give you a sense of switching off to the world and focusing on the fucking free spins?
Look, I remember my first anxiety attack, and I would have been fucking 17, and I was riding home from my mate's house, and I was pushing my bike up the hill, and my heart started racing, and I felt really fucking weird, and it lasted for about 10 seconds. It was only very minor, and I was like, whoa, what the fuck was that? Anyway, I thought nothing of it. So, you know, I still continued, you know, smoking weed, whatever. And then we turned 18, then we started taking ecstasy. There was none of this, you know, I'm only 35, but when I was 18, there was I'd never even heard of fucking cocaine. No, yeah. It wasn't even around. Like, people with ecstasy. It was fucking ecstasy or speed. Yep. And
that's right. It wasn't ice. It was just gas.
Yeah. Mm. And we started, you know, taking ecstasy on weekends, and we're doing our thing and smoking a lot of weed and whatnot. And anyway, I started working for my uncle, and my uncle, you know, he's had a, you know, he does drugs.
Yep.
Fuck, I don't even know if I should say that, but whatever.
We don't need to know his name, but
anyway. Yeah, yeah. Look, and I worked for him for a bit, and, you know, I knew he did drugs, and he offered me some speed.
Yep.
And I took it, and he said, are you sure you've had this? And I thought I did, but I hadn't. And I went to a party on the weekend, and I was smoking marijuana or whatever, and we came home, and we're smoking weed with my friends, and, you know, this is the same night he gave me that stuff in the Arvo. And that early morning when I'm with my friends smoking weed after a party, they all left. And then all of a sudden this fucking panic just went, like, and I was fucking shitting myself, ringing the hospital, like, I'm fucking dying. They're like, no, you're just having a panic attack. You need to calm down. I'm freaking the fuck out. And my parents were away and everything, so I was there by myself. And I'm laying in the ground in a fetal position thinking I'm going crazy. Like, have I got schizophrenia, or have I lost my fucking mind, or, you know, I didn't know what was going on. And it fucked me for months. I was just sleeping I was fucking 18 years old, sleeping on the floor next to my parents' bed because I was that fucking scared, and I didn't know what was going on, and they didn't know, you know, mental, even, what am I now, 35, so when I was 18, how many years ago is that, you know?
Oh, think of it. So, well, 18 years.
Yeah, okay, well, 18 years ago, even then, mental health wasn't so... what it is now.
No,
it's more
not at
known,
all. The
you know?
Education wasn't there. So, everything was just, oh, look, take your tablet. This is
yeah, so even my parents, and they love me and they care about me, they didn't even, and it's not their fault, but they didn't know. Mm. You know, they didn't know. So, you know, this went on for a period of time where I couldn't even leave the fucking house. I was flipping the fuck out. Anyway, I ended up gradually it kind of faded away. And I hadn't touched weed or anything because I thought, fuck, if I touch that, I'm going to fucking die. So I went to another party and I ended up smoking again, and it came back even worse, and it flipped the fuck out, and it just, yeah, it was just fucking crazy. And anyway, from that moment on, I never touched drugs again in my life. So yeah, I think it's been since I was like 19, I haven't touched drugs. Yeah. Because I'm too afraid.
Yeah.
Because
which look, is, I guess in hindsight, especially in the way things are today, scared the life out of you, you know. Yeah. It has allowed you to... never, I guess, be curious and never want to go down that road.
Nah, because, you know? Look, mate, I can't tell you how many times I've been drunk, even after this whole powerfish thing, and I've been out, and people are throwing cocaine at me, coming in toilets, like, you know, and I've never even done cocaine once in
my
whole
life.
It's
just a thing that they think that, you know, oh, yeah.
Yeah, he does drugs.
You're the powerfish, you do drugs.
He does drugs, yeah, you right. know, but no, and, you know, I've never been tempted at all, and I know it sounds so dumb because of people like, it's just a panic attack. Calm down. Like, it's not a big deal. Like, until, you know, it's until it's fucking happened to you, like, you have no fucking idea.
Yeah.
And that's where it began. And, you know, the anxiety and panic disorders never really left my life. It's always been there, but it comes in waves and it comes high and it goes slow. So I think for now, like, it's been nearly 15 years. No, yeah, it would be 13 years, I reckon, that I've been taking actual medication for this disorder. And it's been the same medication for this long, but it's never fixed it. And it's never really even taken it 50% away. But I haven't changed the other medications or anything. I've been too afraid. And I've just wanted to stay on this. And it got to a point where I was comfortable living, but there were boundaries which I could and couldn't do.
Sure.
And some of these boundaries, and people might not understand, it may be a form of agoraphobia. Mixed in with the panic disorder, where you can't leave too far away from your house. And the further you go away from your house, the more you feel that you think these are going to come on and grab you and fuck you up, and you feel like you're going to die. Even though you know in your head you're not going to die, you still think. And when you think about these things, that's when it comes on. So if it happened, I don't know, say fucking 50 kilometers away from my house, the next time I go back 50 kilometers, I'm thinking in my head, hang on, when I was here last time, it fucking got me. It's going to get me again. And by you thinking about it, it brings it on.
It does, yeah.
So,
and just to touch on that too, and if you don't mind, I mean, we've been planning to sit down and do this, you know, for a little bit now. And, you know, this is what happens.
Yeah.
It pops up. We're not that far from each other,
you
know. And unfortunately, it's just something that, you know, we have to overcome. And for people that don't understand, for Willem actually being here today, it's absolutely huge. And I've got to be really honest, mate. I'm so proud of you and grateful for you to take that step, because it's not okay.
I don't expect people to understand. You know, it's one of those things. If you haven't got it, you don't know. But, you know, a lot, I get messages of people and they say, oh, you know, like, fuck, you're such a good role model, like you come out the other side of it. And it's like, no, I fucking haven't. I'm still in the same fucking place. I really am.
Coming out the other side, and I think you need to really sort of give yourself a bit of credit here. I mean, like I said, some of my guests have fought some heavy addictions. I had a lawyer from Brisbane, whom you know, come on, who, mate, battled one of the toughest addictions. I have had another great man, Russell Mansour, with a heroin addiction. You had a gambling addiction.
Yeah, gambling and drug addiction.
Let's talk about it. Let's get right in it. And I want to come through to how you overcome it. What was the day like for Willem?
Yeah, wow. It was basically waking up and doing anything I could, lie. Never stole, but lie to get money from family and friends. Yeah, it's very difficult to talk about. It's very embarrassing. And
don't be embarrassed, brother, because at the end of the day, it's your story. And I truly believe that there's not a person out there after hearing this would ever feel embarrassed. I
mean, yeah.
I guess it's like me opening up about my sexual abuse that I endured and suffered. It's not easy.
Yeah.
It's not. But...
No,
what you're doing is hopefully stopping others.
Yeah, and look, gambling's a very, very dangerous addiction. I can't believe the hold it had on me and changed my life so much that I was a completely different person. It's exactly, if not worse, to being a very heavy drug addict, because you would do anything to get money just to press that fucking machine, to watch those reels spin.
Would you sit there all day?
And you get I get written the fuck off.
You're drinking at the same time. Yeah, and
everything. And this is near the end of where I stopped photography. Always in and out of the pawn shop, hocking all my shit. Anything I could fucking get that was mine, it was going in there. And I was going to get that money and I was going to put it through those machines. Whether I won 5, 10 grand, it was all going to go back in. I was never going to leave with the money.
So what was the rush? What was the chase behind it? For those that have never gambled, what is it?
The addiction is so crippling and strong. It's so hard to even try and explain that you're just not yourself. And I'm walking in these places, I don't even want to fucking win.
Yeah.
I don't. It's the fucking sound, it's the smells, it's the alcohol, it's fuck, it's everything.
Is it like being in a little dark corner of the place where the world's not there? And
so everything that leads up to actually gambling itself, and I mean just the mission and the adventure of trying to get that money in the first place and then go there, so the steps that lead up to it, it's all part of it.
So in this case, this game that we're seeing here is titled Super Chicken. The bonuses are based on the hatching of baby chicks. There needs to be something that pulls them to the machine, and that's what the graphics are.
See, that's very interesting you say that, and I'll just put this in, you know, for example, like my life getting done with drug importation and others that we've had on the show with different highs and rushes. You know, the whole logistics behind creating, preparing, waiting, getting, it's all on edge. It's all exciting, you know. Fuck, I wouldn't even... Don't even have a conversation with me today about it. But the point of what I'm saying is, in reference to what you're describing, is you're chasing.
Yeah.
Every stage of it is exciting for that moment, you know. But there's always that fucking other side, isn't there?
I wanted to lose.
Really?
I did. Yeah, I did. At the same time, I had a...
Did you actually win? Like,
I won many times and it all went straight back in. I was never ahead. You're a gambler, you're never ahead. Yeah, it's a loser's game. It's fucking, it's not rocket science, you know. But yeah, look, it was a self-destruction course as well. It was me trying to escape reality from my mental health, and it was an addiction that was inevitably, I was going to kill myself. And it all kind of stopped when I said, if I don't stop now... It's either one thing, keep gambling or go kill yourself.
That's just a sample of some of the great people we've had on the podcast. You can head back to each episode and listen again if you want. And if you want to support the show, head to our Patreon page, which you'll find in our show notes. For as little as $5 per month, you can help us keep bringing you these stories of redemption. Simo will return with Season 3 of The Clink in mid-January.
For the record, I'm done trying to make y'all comfortable. That's right. For the record, you ain't trying to grow, then it's done for you. That's right. For the record, lab on me going all the way. All the way. For the record, ain't trying to link, no time to waste. Stop calling. For the record, 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 for the record.
Want to thank a new sponsor who's just come on board, Dr. Pickles Tattoo Aftercare and Lifestyle Products. They're made in Brisbane and are known right around the world. They have this amazing balm. It's called the Original Tattoo Balm. You seal and protect your tattoo with the OG. I've just been using it on my leg after I had it done, and I tell you now, my skin feels amazing and there's a great shine to it. They also have an antiseptic spray you can spray on and wipe over your tattoo to keep it nice and clean so you don't get any infections. They've got a 3-in-1 wash. It's all natural, smells great, packed full of peppermint, citrus, and wait for it, hemp oils. How good's that? Plus, they have a SPF 50 sunscreen, which acts as a moisturizer as well as protecting your tattoos from fading and stop them from getting sun damage. Right now, though, for the Clink listeners, they're offering 15% off with the code CLINK. Just head to drpickles.com. That's drpickles.com.